Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On the show today, we're getting all nostalgic and misty-eyed as we look back on the show throughout 2017. This year, we introduced a new strand to the programme called Something Old, Something New. We're invited in a duo from the creative world every month. They might be brothers, sisters, old friends or ex-colleagues who dabble in the worlds of writing, art, design, singing, publishing and much more. In each episode, we ask them to pick something old and something new that have interested or inspired them at some point in their lives and careers. And these conversations have provoked stories about family, friendship, craft, and the day-to-day lives of creative minds. So let's hear a few of our favourite choices by our guests this year. Staying true to form, we'll begin with the Something Olds. Back in May, I had the designer Paula Scher and her friend and fellow designer Adrian Shaughnessy in the studio. While Adrian picked posters from his house and the bike he rides around town on, Paula picked the tools that she's used throughout her career. Her Something Old was an X-Acto knife.
Generally, an X-Acto knife was used to cut pieces of paper, to cut mat boards. It was one step more contemporary than a mat knife, which is a much thicker object and theoretically can cut heavier things. But there were certain people who thought that the pure razor blade was even better. So as an old object, it was actually new of its kind, and others frowned upon it. I absolutely came into working life with an X-Acto knife and thought it was spectacular. I thought it was sleek and cool and great and fast, that if you wanted to cut out any kind of form, you could do it almost instantaneously, and it was perfect.
Right from back in the day when you started, this was the tool that felt like home when it was in your hand.
Absolutely. First, it was doing mechanicals with it, but then I would make montages with it, and I would cut out just to see what something looked like. I would hack it out very quickly if you wanted to see two colors together. Nothing better than cutting out a small and big piece of paper and putting them down and looking at them. Much faster and more accurate than doing it on the computer. Really fantastic.
It's interesting that you used the X-Acto knife, which I think is an American tool. We Brits of a similar vintage, pre-computer, and we still use them, we used the scalpel. But I think X-Acto has a retractable blade, doesn't it?
You slip it in and slip it out.
Yeah. The scalpel, which is the same scalpel that surgeons used, is a metal blade.
Would you have to sharpen it then?
No, you can take off and replace the blade when it gets blunt.
But that's what an X-Acto is.
Yeah, but they're different.
I never saw a scalpel.
honestly, you will have.
This, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is the sound of two designers getting on famously. Well, this is the thing. So X-Acto is, to tell people what the brand is, how it's spelled anyway, it's an X dash Acto. Right. And so it sounds none more American, none more 50s sounding. It sounds like a great brand, doesn't it? X-Acto. It could only be American.
It totally sounded zippy. And it was.
Yeah.
It was
it was
fleet. The mat knife is a big, heavy thing, and you really can't do corners well with it. Razor blade is wonderful, you know, because you can, you know, sort of slide something in there, but you also cut your finger faster.
Yeah. Has anything been made for your line of work as satisfying as the X-Acto knife that has that quality of tactility?
You know, there are objects you appreciate for their beauty, and there are things that you love and that you crave that you want to buy. I have to say that when you ask the question about it, not a huge amount comes to mind. But when you talk about an experience with something, that's very different. And that, for me, the X-Acto knife had to do with when I started designing. And I imagine I would feel that way about a razor blade if I was 20 years older.
Yeah.
And something else if I was 20 years younger.
2017 was a very good year for one of our book reviewers, Charmaine Lovegrove. She launched a new publishing house called Dialogue Books, an imprint of Little Brown, specialising in literature by people from minority groups. She appeared on an episode with her friend, the writer Elizabeth Day, which was presented by Tom Edwards. Her Something Old harked back to the origins of her love for books.
So my Something Old is a bookshelf. Well, it's a bookcase from Foyles. So Foyles was my favourite bookshop as a child, other than Brollingbrook Bookshop, which is in Battersea, which is where I'm from. And Foyles was, you know, 25 minutes from my house, from Clapham Junction, to get to Tottenham Court Road. you know, it's always held like a very magical place in my heart, because I would go there and get lost for hours when I was supposed to be elsewhere and probably at a birthday party or something. But on Saturdays when I was a child, and, you know, when I was sort of 9, 10, I actually started going to Foyles by myself.
And lost is the operative word, because for some of our international listeners might not know, this was a more sort of, it was a more esoteric bookshop. It wasn't a
Absolutely.
Sort of standard high street,
this
alphabetized.
Like, exactly. It was just kind of like it was a Pandora's box of a bookshop. So you'd walk in and you'd have these old wooden bookcases, and it didn't really make sense, the order. And because the Christina Foyle, who owned the bookshop at the time, she didn't think that there were going to be credit card machines were going to last, so you had this sort of ticket, really weird ticketing system of, you would collect a book from one place and pay for it sort of four floors down, and in between you would just come across all these magnificent books. So I got really lost in there as a child, and it really allowed my reading to grow in a way that nothing else really had. You know, it really is where my love of bookshops really comes from. And then having owned a bookshop in Berlin, you know, bookshelves and bookcases and that, how you display books and then how you go back to books is something really important to me.
And where does it live, if I can ask? Is it, because it's quite, I'm imagining quite a sizable bookcase, is it?
So what happened was that Foyles then closed for a big refurbishment a few years ago. It was before I moved to Berlin. So I think it was like 2006. So they had a refurbishment, not the recent one, the one before. So they had a refurbishment, and I had worked in Foyles when I was 18. I ran the Black literature section, which now thankfully is integrated into other types of literature. And I went back and I saw my old boss, Jasper, who was wonderful. And then I said, "What are you doing with the bookshelves?" And he was just like, "Do you want one?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure. I'd love to have a bookshelf from Foyles." So I took this bookcase. It's a case, it's not a shelf. I put the bookcase on the 38 bus. Okay. And it was when the buses were the old Route Masters. I wasn't thinking. I just got in there to buy a book, and then I sort of came out with this case, and then I took it to, on the 38 bus to Hackney, where I was living on the at the time. And it was just so inconvenient and so annoying, and the bus conductor was just like, "What is this?" And I was like, "It's a bookcase, you know, you should be happy, I'm reading."
How big is it?
It's huge. It's like a proper, you know, it can like, hold, it
like
can hold like
foot.
200 books. Wow. Yeah, it's bigger than me, and it's wider than me. And in some, and because
I'm
I had
impressed, you dragged that onto a Route Master.
I just was like, well, what else? I mean, I needed it, right? So then I took it. Then it moved with me. I lived opposite the British Museum for a while, and I basically carried this bookcase around with me for years, and I moved it to Berlin, and now it's in our flat in Herne Hill, and it's just like this bookcase. And it's so important to me, because I just, you know, I just always think all of these people that would have used it to buy books that are in their house, and now I have the bookcase, and I'm like super sentimental about things like that.
Charmaine Lovegrove's pal, Elizabeth Day, who's the author of The Party, also had a great something old, a cigarette case that belonged to her granddad, which sparked this story.
This is my grandfather's cigarette case. So it is the kind of thing you would see in a 1940s black and white film. It's a sort of burnished silvery colour. It's rectangular in shape, and it's got this really beautiful smooth spring mechanism. And I just press the button and it springs open. And inside it's engraved with my grandfather's initials, WH. He was called William Harpham. And it also has a place, Cairo, and a date, 1940 to 1944.
Wow.
And I take this cigarette case everywhere I go. So my grandfather was a really formative influence for me. His name was William Harpham. He was born in Grimsby. He was the son of a policeman. And he managed to make his way through his sheer kind of native wit to grammar school, and then on to Cambridge, where he won a scholarship and he studied modern languages. And then he joined the diplomatic service, and he was posted to the League of Nations after the First World War. And the League of Nations was based in Geneva, and it was there that he met the woman who was to become my grandmother, who was Swiss. And he met her on a date where he was meant to be set up with her sister, but actually liked the look of my grandmother instead. And then when the Second World War broke out, they knew that they liked each other, but nothing had ever really been said. And I think my grandfather at the time was engaged to a different woman, and because he'd met my grandmother, he broke that off. And they then conducted their relationship via telegram and letter across occupied Europe. My grandmother from rural Switzerland and my grandfather wherever he was posted. He ended up proposing to her via telegram, and she accepted.
Are you sure this wasn't actually like from Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene or something?
That's what it sounds like.
It doesn't sound like reality at all. It's amazing.
I always wondered about that, but actually when my grandmother died very sadly a few years ago, we found all the letters, and it was exactly as the story had been told to us. And there was one particular element of the story that I loved, which was my grandfather designing his ideal engagement ring and my grandmother doing the same and the letters crossing, and it was the same ring.
Oh my gosh.
Designed.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not buying. This is definitely from a novel. Maybe unpublished, but it's definitely
from a
novel.
And then it gets better. Is that so having sort of accepted my grandfather's proposal, my grandmother then engaged in an incredibly perilous journey across occupied Europe and met him in Cairo, where they got married.
Where else could it
Where they be? Got married in 1944. So that's why the cigarette case is incredibly special to me, not only as a memory of my beloved grandparents, who were really amazing people, but also as a reminder of the power of story and love.
Okay, time for something new then. These are the things that might be brand new to the entire world or might be old things that have been recent sources of inspiration for our guests. One episode we did back in April featured the writer Alex Preston and his publisher at Faber & Faber, Walter Donahue. Walter had recently been to the theatre to see An American in Paris, which prompted him to pick up a book of Ira Gershwin's notes on his lyrics.
I had a copy of the Ira Gershwin's book about having wrote the lyrics. So after I saw the musical, which is incredibly entertaining, and because of the music, it's just kind of just emotionally overwhelming. So I went back to see what he had to say about the songs that are in it. Also because I think, I knew we were going to talk about stories, but I thought it would be good to sometimes to talk about words. Like,
so you got, I got rhythm here. And he talks about why that's a more powerful way of saying it than I've got or I have got rhythm. I guess it's direct, it's all the rest of it. But the way he writes about his own writing is quite amazing.
Yeah, he says that it's not I've got rhythm, it's just I got. In other words, so it's very, the music is, I can't sing, and so I won't try to do that. It is, the opening song in this production, and it just boom, 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 it just grabs you. And what he's interesting is, in terms of how you use words, he says got is actually the past tense of get, but that's not how he used the word got. He got as if it was actually have. So like he says, if you say I've got a toothache, it's not you had a toothache in the past, it's I have it right now. So using got, I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, you can ask for anything more. It's very, very kind of direct.
I got Daisy. I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Old man trouble.
There is something amazing, there's something quite intimate about that. There is the idea, also perfected by Ira Gershwin, of knowing how to do it perfectly so you can do it wrong with style, as presumably how he uses language, like all good writers, I suppose. When you look at this, do you kind of feel like it's something that you can simply read, the writing about his lyrics? Is it a nourishing thing to read even if you don't know the tunes?
Yeah, because the lyrics are right in front of you, so you can refer back to it. And he says, like in one of the songs, he uses never, never, no, no. He keeps on repeating these words, always, always. And then he says that, in retrospect, he found a better way of doing it. But in fact, this repetition, which is so odd, always, always, never, never, no, no, gives a kind of flow to it, you know. That's what was interesting to me. Like when that song, It's Wonderful, you know, he said he gets really angry when you know, people sing it as it's wonderful, it's marvelous. And the whole reason why he wrote the song, the lyrics that way, because he liked to play with the fact that it's has an S, the next word, and just take the S off the it, and put it in front of wonderful.
It's wonderful, it's marvelous, you should care for me.
More recently, we spoke to the writers Dan Richards and Melissa Harrison. Dan told us about the odd story that made him discover a new poet, and Melissa told us about the music that first made her feel like part of a community and now plays a bigger part in her career. Mark Doty, the poet, who is a name who I hadn't encountered before. You flagged this up, Dan, and wanted to read something about it. Give us a little bit of a background on Mark and on why you love him.
Well, my introduction to Mark Doty was very much circuitous and around the houses. While I was writing my Climbing Days book, I received a very mysterious letter from a lady, and the letter ran something along the lines of, "When I was a child, I met your great-great-aunt and uncle, and they were the focus of that book." And she said, "My parents knew them very well. I was a child. My parents are dead. I really can't remember very much. So I don't really see how I can be much help to be honest. But if you want to come down to Dorset and see me about them, you're very welcome. But as I say, I don't think it'll be worth your while. All best wishes, Salima Hill." And at the time, I was...
"The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away."
Indeed.
Sentence by sentence.
What a strange circular letter. Yeah. But it was wonderful. It's always nice to receive letters anyway. And the name rang a bell. And Salima Hill turns out to be, as you know, a lot of your listeners hopefully will know, just the most wonderful, amazing poet. And again, you were talking about magical realism, the Brautigan, and she really embodies a kind of very Angela Carter-esque, earthy, bloody magical realism in her poetry. And, you know, she's a real cult figure. And the fact she'd written me such a strange letter. So I responded and I said, "Hello, I'm not sure how to respond to this letter, but thank you so much." And then we got talking and it turned out that she was on the shortlist for the T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize last year. But she wasn't going to go. Because she doesn't do that sort of thing.
Okay. I sense she might not be.
No, that would be too easy to actually turn up at, you know, the South Bank and actually, you know, read.
Be
and
lauded.
She said, "Do you want to go instead of me?" And I said, "Well, will I have to stand on stage and read your poetry?" She went, "Oh, no, don't be silly. There are people for that, Dan." I said, sorry, that was ridiculous. But I ended up going along in her stead, I think with her granddaughter, and there we both were, and almost everybody else was reading, and Mark Doty was on stage because he was also shortlisted, and he read this poem. And so my introduction to his work came from the man himself on stage at Royal Festival Hall reading a couple of poems from the collection Deep Lane, which was shortlisted, and it absolutely blew me away. And then I got a copy of the book, and I read the book, and then it sat next to my bed with all the books in the big Pisa-like pile of toppling books that are next to my bed. But I've spent the last month in America, and the book went with me to America, because just before leaving, I remembered this particular poem, "This Your Home Now." And with everything that's going on in America, with everything that's going on in the world, it struck me that I needed that when I went to America, just because this poem, for me at least, is everything that America should be.
Dull early winter, back on 18th, just past the post office, up spiraling red in a cylinder of glass, and just below the line of sidewalk, a new sign, Willie's Barbershop. Dark hallway, glass door, and there's, presumably, Willie. When I tell him I used to go down the street, he says in an inscrutable accent, "This your home now." Puts me in a chair, asks me what I want, and soon he's clipping and singing with the radio's Latin dance tune. That's when I notice Willie's walls, though he's been here all the week, spangled with images hung in barbershops since the beginning of time. Lounge singers, near celebrities, random boxers, Italian boys, Puerto Rican, caught in the hour of their beauty, though they'd scowl at the word, cheering victors over a trophy won for what? Frames already dusty, at slight angles. Here, it's clear forever.
Melissa, you're something new. It's been going on for quite a while as well. You've gone, as as Dan has bored down into the specificity of some of the language and some of the writers and poets he loves, you've gone for another broad church here.
I have.
Dartmoor, we go to dance music.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And also, what I loved when you flagged this up as something you wanted to talk about, I was like, yes. This is the nature writer that's getting on one. Right?
This is me coming out of the closet.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go to dance. Should we take a little... Why don't you introduce our listeners to something that is emblematic of the sort of dance music that you like?
With pleasure. This is a track called In White Rooms by Booker Shade.
You thought Melissa Harrison was just reciting Keats to herself as she walked across Dartmoor, but in fact it's In White Rooms, original mix brackets by Booker Shade.
Yeah, I'm having a slightly Pavlovian moment here.
Yeah, are you? Where are we going?
We're going back to the
You're
cross.
You're remembering how you met Dan now? Oh, the cross!
No, much further back. I don't even know if Dan's a dance music man, are you, Dan?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. That was good.
Truly.
And yeah. Talking about Pavlovian moments, everyone got the water out at that moment.
I know.
Everyone
went for the water. It's like, oh, it's important to keep hydrated,
it's
isn't
really
it?
Hot. Yeah, it's good. So tell us about where did the love affair with dance music come from? And people will want to know how this is not incongruous with the love of getting out into the great outdoors and that great improvement in Kugel technology from the 1970s.
I think it is incongruous, actually, and that's part of the appeal for me. My other job is I'm production editor at a dance music magazine called Mix Mag and have been for 12 years. But long beyond that, I remember the second summer of love, 1988.
Yeah.
I was 13, so I was too young to take part in the M25 raves or go to Shoom or anything like that, but it was in the air. The older kids at school, there was a lot of sneakily showing off your pot of Vicks that you had and one white glove, all of that. I think my older sister went to some of the raves. But I was 18 when I discovered dance music for myself, and it was my first year at Oxford. I went to a comprehensive school and from there to Oxford, where I didn't fit in at all, as you can imagine. I already hadn't fitted in at comprehensive, where I was clever and bookish and bespectacled and bullied. And I got to Oxford and began going out with a guy who became my first husband. Bless him, lovely man. We used to go to Club UK in London. We used to get the Oxford Tube coach to London. Go out all night and then get the coach back in the morning, because there was no subculture at all in Oxford that I could discover. It was about working really hard, which I also did, and I'm proud of how well I did, but there wasn't anywhere else to be apart from the university. There was boat club cocktails, things like that.
Yeah.
And if you weren't going to fit in with that, there wasn't a lot for you. And what I discovered was, and you know, it sounds like a massive cliche, but I discovered a sense of community that was incredibly important to me at the time. I discovered somewhere I fitted in, and I discovered that I was acceptable and could be accepted by other people. And that's never worn off, and I needed that. But for a long time, when I first discovered it, it really was a subculture. It was like joining a secret club. You would occasionally meet someone and you'd say, do you go to clubs? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I do. Oh, okay. And you would have a bond based on that. It's hard to imagine now. But I think what was important to me in terms of writing was that it allowed me to feel comfortable with being an outsider. It allowed me to take some strength and even pride in not fitting into the mainstream. And that, for me, has been a really important position to take. And it's something that I'm now really comfortable with. And I think it informs my writing, because it can give you empathy when you're not on the inside of things. It can give you empathy with other types of ways to live, other kinds of people.
To end the show, we're going to hear from the guest on our most recent episode of Something Old, Something New, the actor Ed Skrein and his friend and platinum-selling musician Plan B. They told us how Barry Jenkins' film Moonlight provided such a masterclass in movie-making and storytelling for the both of them.
Give me a hand. your head, rest in my hand. Relax. I got you, I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you. There you go. 10 seconds. See that right there? You're in the middle of the world.
I'll never forget where I was sitting in that cinema, three seats from the back on the, you know, from the left in the back row, and just what an effect it had on me. You know, there's so much about this movie, I could talk about it so long, but like the cinematography is just beautiful. You know, it's gorgeous, the anamorphic lenses, the blurring that you get from it, the 360 shots, the one shots that they do are just so beautiful. The acting is so subtle, the subject matter is so important. That we have, yes, a coming-of-age story, and yes, we're giving voice to, you know, young kids, inner-city kids, you know, from the ghettos in Miami and whatnot. But this is a story about a young man struggling with his homosexuality in the black community. You know, it's so important. You know, we talk about voices and the voices that we hear, but all of the voices, most of the voices that we hear are just white, European or North American voices. We don't hear these stories. And it's so important we hear these stories for people all around the world that want to, that are going through these things. And then as a storyteller, you know, I felt like they left so much out. They cut all the fat out of it. There was no exposition, you know. They never explained what happened to Juan, to Blue, to Mahershala's character.
Did you know you might work for Barry Jenkins when you watched this movie?
No, it's crazy because this...
should say that If Beale Street Could Talk is Barry Jenkins' next movie. Are you shooting that right now?
No, I shot that at the beginning of the month in New York.
Yeah.
And that was just like... It meant so much to me. And the time scale is very interesting because I only heard about the movie from Mahershala exactly 1 year ago. Saw the movie... Love the movie, and that movie actually really helped me finish off writing a short film, which I've just finished directing on the weekend. After I'd worked with Barry, I said to him, I hope you know that I'm going to just copy you completely for this short film, and same with the DOP. But when Moonlight was in the cinema, I said, right, I'm going to take the whole cast, and I want you all to come and watch this movie, because this is how you act. This is how you tell stories, and this is... you know, the benchmark for how it's done. So I took this cast of like 8 kids, teenagers, early 20s, and we went to the Hackney Picture House. And I forgot something. I forgot how generational certain things are. Now I'm 34, I'm a dad of 2. I don't even think about the homosexuality in it. Really, it's just a love story. Now, as soon as any of the homosexual stuff was going on in it, you could just see them going, covering their face. Oh,
the kids.
And when we came out afterwards, all they could talk about was, but would you do that though? Would you take that role though? Tell the truth. Like, if you was offered that, would you take that? And I was taken aback by it. And Moonlight is this beautiful, sophisticated, elegant, wonderful story that kind of, I wonder if we'd have seen it when we were 17, what kind of reaction we would have had to it, you know what I mean?
The thing is, we're talking about voices for the voiceless. You know, there's no more voiceless people. If you think that coming from poverty generally makes you quite voiceless, well, coming from poverty and being gay in such a homophobic environment, such as the streets are, they're even more voiceless. Those people, and yet it does come down to being immature at that age and allowing peer pressure to affect the way you react to homosexuality. Also, it's like, the older we get, we forget about that stuff.
Yeah. There's a lot of face and keeping of and saving of face, isn't there?
But it's great that, you know, we were once kids just like the ones that you brought to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then now in our 30s, you know, that stuff just doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's it makes me feel very optimistic about the future for these young people that, you know, the rest of society kind of really writes off, because we were those young kids and we've managed to kind of come out of that environment as, you know, positive, free-thinking adults to the point where, you know, we can sit there and appreciate a film like Moonlight.
You know, this is a human problem. If it's a human problem or issue, rather, then it's up to humans to tell that story. You know what I mean? So all of these lines and divisions, you know, they shouldn't be there in art. And, you know, what he did with it was just so beautiful.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Culture. Thanks to all our guests who have appeared on the show throughout 2017. Why not listen to their interviews in full by exploring our archive over the festive period at monocles.com/radio. This show was, of course, produced by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for the time being, have a very Merry Christmas, and thanks for tuning in.